the Buddha sometimes would compare us sentient beings to like children, children in a burning house, burning with the fires of grasping and aversion and confusion. Lost in the fire without even realizing the danger of the house that's burning all around us. And maybe with our playthings in the house, we're not only at great risk with the fire all around us, but our playthings are very hot and we're actually fueling the fire in our confused play in this house. So, in the great Lotus Sutra, the Buddha tells this parable of like a parent watching her children in the burning house and saying, it's really dangerous in there and you're just fueling the fire and it's very hot. We need to cool things down. Why don't you come out of the house? Maybe more than, why don't you come out of the house? Come out of the house, kids! Don't you see it's on fire? And they said, well, not now, Mommy, because we're in the middle of this game. We're so absorbed in our toys and playthings. We don't want to come out now. No, seriously, kids, the house is on fire, come out. And they, just forget about Mommy, we got to finish the game. So then Mommy, Buddha, thinks it's not going to work to just tell him to come out. I have to devise some method, some skillful means to lure them out of the house. I can't be quite so blunt as to just say, come out! It doesn't work. I tried it. I've tried it many times. So we have to be a little more subtle. And we have to, like, look at, look at the disposition of the kids in the house and they seem to be, they don't want to come out because they're so into their toys. So how about I offer them some better toys. Maybe then they'll be willing to come out. At least I should try it, the mom thinks, and I better try it quick. I know you're enjoying the game in there, kids, but out here I have a much better game. It's called Sesshin. This toy is so much fun. You're gonna love it. And you probably heard about this toy Sesshin. If you're into Zen, you know that it's like renowned as maybe our favorite Zen toy. The most renowned Zen toy of all. Sesshin. Gathering the mind and heart. Sitting all day. Eating at our seat. Chanting the Buddha's words. Slowly and nobly walking around the Buddha. It might be kind of hard, but somehow here we are. We actually thought that this would be a more fun toy today than playing on the beach and eating a whole box of chocolate hearts. Plain oatmeal is much more cool toy than chocolate hearts. Especially if you can add a little gomashio. We have lots of toys in our tradition. We have just these wonderful playthings of just daily practice with zazen. The bodhisattva precepts, that might lure us out of the house. Even things like Sangha Day, to like take care of the grounds and the garden at the temple. The Buddha devises all these wonderful, skillful means to slowly lure us children out of this burning house of grasping, aversion, and confusion. In the parable, as the children actually say, "Oh, actually, those toys sound even better than our game. We'll come." They all come running out of the house, and and the parent says, "Actually, you can have the sashin, and you can have the bodhisattva precepts, and you can have daily practice and sangha day and all kinds of playthings. But I'd like to give you the supreme gift, the supreme toyless toy called the One Vehicle." It's one of the central teachings of the Lotus Sutra, the Ekayana, the One Vehicle. It goes beyond even sashin. And what is the One Vehicle? The Buddha never says. Because it's inconceivable. All the toys, even sashin, is conceivable. But the One Vehicle is the greatest gift of all. It's the freedom from the burning house, and it's the freedom from all toys also. And it's very cool. Very, very cool. It's like there's no fire in the vicinity of the One Vehicle. So the Lotus Sutra is full of these parables that are trying to hint at something that can't be said too directly. So I thought these few days we could explore the Lotus Sutra a little bit, especially the chapter that we chanted this morning on the Tathagata's lifespan. This Lotus Sutra, the Mahayana Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, is one of the most renowned, influential Mahayana sutras in this kalpa, in this world system. It seemed to appear in this world system around the second century. It's early Mahayana sutra. And it appeared in India and spread to Tibet and China and Korea and Japan. And it never like caught on so big in Tibet. Of course, they have a translation of it from way early on, but they were into other sutras more. But somehow, in East Asia, China and Korea and Japan, this Lotus Sutra, like, really, really flourished. Some people might say the most important sutra, most influential sutra in the vast land of China and Japan. Of course, we have the Heart Sutra, is very influential too, but Lotus Sutra is Somehow that Chinese culture maybe really resonated with these parables. Lotus Sutra, a lot of it comes in the form of stories, unlike some other sutras. It comes in parable-like stories, and as we know, Chinese were really into expressing Zen through stories. So maybe something about Chinese culture, they love stories. And the Lotus Sutra is the most storied sutra. And in our particular tradition of Soto Zen, of course, Zen in China was influenced by the Lotus Sutra. There's discussions about it in the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor and so on. But by the time of Dogen Zenji in the 13th century of Japan, the Lotus Sutra was, I would think it's fair to say, like the central sutra in Japan when Dogen was born. Because the tradition in Japan was the Tendai school, in Japanese we say Tendai sect or school of Buddhism, was, you could say, the dominant school, but almost like the only school at the time of Dogen in Japan. It had become so popular and so powerful and so widespread and influential that everybody who practiced Buddhism, I think pretty much, there were maybe some other really minor schools, but they maybe kept getting folded into the Tendai system. So pretty much everybody was all practicing Buddhists were in the Tendai school. And the Tendai school was founded in China in the 6th century by Jur-yi. And I think he was one who felt like the Lotus Sutra is the most important sutra and made it this kind of a centerpiece of his teachings. So Dogen was ordained as a priest in the Tendai school. Have you heard that? Dogen was not ordained as a Zen priest. There wasn't any Zen yet in Japan. But then, as a Tendai school priest, Dogen started hearing about the Zen thing, and so then he went to China, because it wasn't in Japan. He went to China to find it, and he brought it back, Zen. But because Dogen grew up in his Tendai school, the Lotus Sutra was central to his understanding of Buddha Dharma. And then even after Dogen, we could say, kind of converted to Zen and founded the Zen tradition, he still constantly talked about the Lotus Sutra. Dogen Shogo Genzo is filled with quotes and comments on the Lotus Sutra, chapter after chapter. I think it's fair to say it's the most commented on sutra in Dogen's Shogo Genzo. And this chapter 16 that we chanted this morning is one of the maybe two most commented on chapters. Dogen felt that the Lotus Sutra was so important. So like in our meal chant, we chant the 10 names of Buddha. We chanted at various times for opening and closing of practice periods and for meals. These 10 names of Buddha goes way, way back in China, long before Dogen. But has anyone ever counted those 10 names of Buddha? If you ever count them, you'll notice that there's not 10. There's 11. So for many centuries in China, there was the 10 names of Buddha, but Dogen felt so strongly about the Lotus Sutra that he's like, we gotta add it in to the names of Buddha. The Lotus Sutra is a Buddha. And so there's 11. And that's Dogen's addition. So I don't know, like in Rinzai Zen, they chant the 10 names of Buddha. I actually don't know if they chant the Lotus Sutra. Yeah?
In Thai, I don't
But I mean, in the 10 names of Buddha. Yeah, in the 10 names of Buddha. I think that's a unique thing that Dogen added to, almost like adding to a scripture in a way, these 10 names of Buddha. Let's add an 11th name and still call it the 10 names, because 10 is a nice round number. In our chant, it's homage to the Mahayana Sadharma Pundarika Sutra. The Mahayana Sadharma Pundarika Sutra. In Japanese meal chant, we say, like, Daijo, the great vehicle, the Mahayana. Myoho Rengekyo, wondrous Dharma, lotus flower sutra. And not only that, but in the Soto Zen tradition, well, here we sometimes chant this chapter of the Lotus Sutra, but it's not so popular in American Zen. I think San Francisco Zen Center, they do not have that chant in their sutra book. But in Japan, Soto Zen, there's a kind of standard sutra book for the whole country of Japan for the Soto Zen tradition. And service, like morning service, is pretty standard. Temples can do variations on it. But when I practiced in Japan and traveled around to different temples, there were slight variations, but most people chant the standard service. It's pretty long, longer than our morning service, maybe half an hour. And every day they chant the verse from chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra on the universal gateway of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, speaking of this Bodhisattva's great compassion that rescues all suffering beings. That's like every morning. And every morning they chant the Lotus Sutra's lifespan of the Tathagata. Not even like alternating days. Not even like skipping days off. Every morning, decade after decade, century after century, in many temples, they chant the Lotus Sutra's lifespan of the Tathagata. I still recall every day how the at Bukokuji, where I practiced, the Doan would announce, Myoho Rengekyo Nyorai Juyo Honge. It's kind of a long title, because they say the wondrous Dharma, Lotus Flower Sutra, lifespan of the Tathagata, chapters, verse, is what that whole title means. And I, as I recall, we chanted it with Mokugyo. It's in Japanese, but we kept the beat and we did it pretty fast, because there's a lot to chant. So something about this chapter 16, this verse that we chanted this morning, is like a central daily chant. Along the Heart Sutras chanted every morning service also. The different parts of the service are dedicated to different, dedicating the merit to different intentions, just like we do here. And so this Lotus Sutra's lifespan of the Tathagata at morning service in Japan is dedicated to the deceased practitioners of this temple, all the deceased Sangha members in the phenomenal world. Some of you know this dedication we do at evening service is, in Japan, that's part of morning service, and it's goes with this chant. So it's, and I think that's not coincidence that this vast, long lifespan of the Buddha is dedicated to these dying sentient beings. There's some connection there. It's dedicated to the deceased. It's also chanted at like memorial services for Dogen, for example. and maybe the Founders Memorial. It's this kind of standard memorial service chant for both parishioners of the temple and for Buddhas and ancestors. I think even like this Parinirvana ceremony would be the standard chant, the Lotus Sutra's lifespan of the Tathagata. So that's why I thought we don't talk about it too much. I thought this is so central to our roots of our tradition. Let's take a look. Lotus Sutra makes all kinds of amazing kind of claims and implies a lot of radical, surprising points. Like, it's kind of implies that all the sutras that came before the Lotus Sutra were just like skillful means of the Buddha, and the Lotus Sutra is finally the real teaching. Things like this. It's kind of big points. And skillful means is a really big part of the Lotus Sutra, like that story of the burning house. Yes. Oh yes, thank you for that question. So in China and Japan, how does Nichiren fit into this? There's many schools of Buddhism in East Asia. And over the centuries, they sometimes split into different schools and they kind of meld together. But in Japan, it's pretty much like the tradition has been for many, many centuries, is there's all these various schools. Zen is one of them. But there's lots of Buddhism in Japan that's not Zen. There's, for example, Vajrayana Buddhism in Japan since like the 7th century, called Shingon. Shingon is the Japanese translation of mantra. There's the mantra school. And all of these schools are influencing each other. And there's the Tendai school, as I just mentioned, in Japan. Both of those are... They're popular, they've been around for a long time, but they're not as widespread as Zen. There's Pure Land School in Japan. And there's Nichiren School. Nichiren is the name of the founder of the school. That their central practice is reciting, almost like a mantra, the title of the Lotus Sutra, if you like. And this goes back to the teachings of Juri in China, who claimed that this whole, it's a pretty big book, but the title alone includes all the teachings in it, and he, would expound on how the title includes all the teachings. So it's kind of, you can summarize the whole book in the title, Myoho Renge Kyo, or Sadharma Pundarika Sutra. But since it's in Japan, they chant the Japanese version, Myoho Renge Kyo. Namu means homage. Namyoho Renge Kyo, Namyoho Renge Kyo, Namyoho Renge Kyo, Namyoho Renge Kyo, Namyoho Renge Kyo. That's their entire practice. Instead of Zazen, it's just reciting the title of the Lotus Sutra. And, so Nichiren lived at the time of Dogen. And Honen and Shinran, the founders of the Pure Land School, the Jodo School in Japan, also lived at the time of Dogen in the 13th century. So, as I mentioned, in Dogen's time, it was just this Tendai school. But this thing happened all within one generation in the 13th century. After centuries of just the Tendai school, there was this creative explosion into all these different schools. They were kind of like they branched out from Tendai and started their own things. All at the same time, they were like contemporaries. I've heard that there's no record anywhere that Dogen ever met Nichiren or Shinran, but they were like, they all lived around, their lives overlapped. They all practiced in the same place, Mount Hiei, the headquarters of the Tendai School, which is still a huge mountain temple complex in Kyoto. They all felt like there's something missing, they felt like, or we want to bring in something new to this Tendai tradition. So Dogen went off to China to bring back the Zen piece. Nichiren found old Tendai statements and about this title of the Lotus Sutra and said, let's make this our central practice. Each of the new schools in the Kamakura period of the 13th century each had a central practice. For Nichiren, it was chanting the title of the Lotus Sutra. For the Pure Land School, it was chanting the name of Amitabha Buddha. For Dogen, it was just wholeheartedly sitting. Shikantaza. Each one had a central, it was even called on this time of the one practice schools, this movement in Japan where these schools branched out. And of course, Dogen talks about other practices, but kind of the style at this time was each school had a central practice that was like their one practice, that was like, all you need is this one practice. That was what was going on at this time. It's nice to know this history, I think, that when we hear things like, without the need for incense offering, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures, just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop off body and mind. That's coming from this time of like these schools all defining themselves by one practice. So Dogen we just have one practice called just sitting. But, of course, he also talked about the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra has these many teachings of skillful means, many parables about skillful means. And Juri, who remembers this Tiantai founder in this China, he kind of looked at the Lotus Sutra as like divided into two sections, right in half. Right, like, exactly. There. There's 28 chapters. So the first 14 chapters is one half, and the second 14 chapters is another half. And he said the first half of the Lotus Sutra is what he called like traces or manifestations of Buddha, which is like conventional teachings like you're in a burning house and we need some method to get out. Like teachings about methods and skillful means and so on. And the second half of the sutra is not about the manifestations, but about like the essence of Buddha, the ultimate nature of Buddha. Follow that? The two halves of the sutra. So maybe the center of the first half is like chapter 2 about skillful means, and the center of the second half, the ultimate half, is chapter 16 on the lifespan of the Jatagata. So it's not just coincidence that Dogen just liked this chapter, or that Soto Zen likes this and puts it in their daily sutra chanting. It's from ancient times in China, this chapter and this verse as being the center of the chapter is said to be the essence of the second half. And the second half of the sutra is kind of the essence of the whole thing. So the part that we chanted this morning is really, you could say, the essence of the entire Lotus Sutra, according to many past Dharma teachers. And I think it fits quite well with the Zen tradition. Dogen seemed to think so, too. So in addition to teaching skillful means and this inconceivable one vehicle, the Lotus Sutra teaches universal Buddhahood, that everybody will be a Buddha. There's all these predictions of Buddhahood. It's not that exactly that everybody is a Buddha already. Sometimes we could say it that way, but the Lotus Sutra just usually puts it more like everybody will become a Buddha. But in a way, we could say it, they will become a Buddha because they already are a Buddha. I found a modern Tendai teacher says it like this. When you become, this is Brooke Zipporin, this wonderful contemporary American Tendai teacher. When you become Buddha, even prior Buddhas who instructed you become aspects of your own present Buddhahood. You become the source of your own source. And this statement that I think is particularly wonderful. To become a Buddha means one has always been a Buddha, but one must become a Buddha in order to have always been a Buddha. I think the Lotus Sutra doesn't say it that directly, but I think he's really captured something. Do you want to hear that again? To become a Buddha means one has always been a Buddha, but one must become a Buddha in order to have always been a Buddha. It's kind of inconceivable. You might say it's just, realizing completely that we have always been a Buddha, but he's putting it a little bit differently. He's almost saying like, the past is created by the present somehow. You've always been a Buddha, and when you realize you've always been a Buddha, it's like becoming Buddha, then your past becomes Buddhahood. We could say it like it's just realizing that the past, realizing all the time we were deluded, was actually Buddha delusion. Sometimes maybe we have these little insights sometimes in our life as practitioners, right? Sometimes we feel like we kind of get something new and feel like relieved and feel actually like on the deepest level, I still have a bunch of problems in my life, but at the deepest level, maybe I really am just okay already. And then along with that, if we then consider, but what about all the times I really, like, I was really confused and really hurt people in the past and really, took a lot of wrong turns and so on. I see now that all that was, like, just completely perfect also. Something like that. It kind of, we recreate the past in light of the present. So another teaching, so this universal Buddhahood, all beings will become Buddhas, and when they become Buddhas, they will see that they've always been Buddhas. But you have to be Buddha in order to fully appreciate that. Right now we're Buddha, but even if we kind of maybe get it somewhat conceptually and can accept ourselves somewhat, I think the full extent of our complete Buddhahood right now will be even more and more revealed when we manifest complete Buddhahood. There's like depth and depth and depth, layers of depth to this Buddhification. And another central teaching of this Lotus Sutra, besides this universal Buddhahood for all sentient beings, even though the Buddha does talk about it's going to be maybe many, many lifetimes before realizing complete Buddhahood in order to see that back there in 2020 in Santa Cruz Zen Center, in that particular lifetime, way back then, we were Buddha then. It's going to take many, maybe many lifetimes to realize that this lifetime is complete Buddhahood. But many lifetimes can be like that. That's another teaching, actually, of this Tian Tai tradition. Like thousands of eons in one moment. Inconceivable. And another great teaching, important teaching of the Lotus Sutra is this primordial Buddhahood. Not only is there universal Buddhahood for all beings, but there's primordial Buddhahood. Primordial, I think, means like before time. And so, of course, this teaching is very related to Buddha nature. We talked a lot about it in the fall, the Parinirvana Sutra, teachings of true self and Buddha nature. This sutra, the Lotus Sutra, never mentions the term Buddha nature or Tathagatagarbha. It never mentions the term Dharmakaya. But it's a very early sutra to appear, so it's kind of like people say that it's kind of the seed for these Buddha nature teachings that would then later be called Buddha nature and Dharmakaya, the true body of the Buddha. The eternal, unchanging Dharmakaya, truth, reality body of the Buddha, will get more and more expounded and understood as the tradition develops. But at the time of the Lotus Sutra, it's just called the lifespan of the Tathagata. This chapter 16 that we chanted this morning is the source for this, for these Buddha nature teachings that will come later. So, maybe good to hear a little bit of the sutra. Chapter 16, the lifespan of the Tathagata. The Buddha said to the great assembly, this is Shakyamuni Buddha, our great original teacher in India, teaching on top of Vulture Peak in Rajgir, not far from Bodh Gaya in present-day India. So it's like he has Shakyamuni Buddha, he has two eyes, two ears, a nose, a tongue, two arms, two legs, and a robe, and a tiny little like curl of hair in his forehead. He's that kind of Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. And he's teaching in, the sutra makes it sound like he's teaching in Sanskrit. And then Kumarajiva translated the sutra in like the 4th century into Chinese. And I think he is responsible partly for why the sutra became so popular in China. He was a very poetic translator and people loved his kind of verse form and flowing translation of Sanskrit into Chinese. So we still have the Sanskrit Sutra and people have translated that into English, and most people translate Kumarajiva's Chinese into English. And but they're very similar. Here the Buddha says to the Bodhisattvas and the great assembly, have trust in and understand, all of you, disciples of Buddha, the truthful words of the Tathagata. All of you, please trust and understand these truthful words of the Tathagata, the Buddha. This is the beginning of the chapter. Then he said to the great assembly, all of you, please trust in and understand the truthful words of the Tathagata. And then he said to the assembly, all of you, trust in and understand the truthful words of the Tathagata. He said this three times. I don't know if there's any other sections in the sutra where he repeats himself three times, but I think he's trying to make a point that, like, I'm about to tell you something really important. In fact, it's the center of the whole sutra. So before I start, please, like, open to trust these words. I'm the Buddha, and you're here because you want to meet the Buddha. So I might say some stuff that you never heard before. It's going to sound kind of weird. So I'm warning you beforehand. Please try to trust me here. Just trust me, okay? Trust and understand. Have faith in. It translated also. The words, the truthful words of the Tathagata. And then the assembly said, okay, we will. Please teach us. And they requested three times. And the Buddha, knowing that they requested three times, he couldn't say no. So he said to them, please listen carefully to hear about the Tathagata's secret and divine powers. In all worlds, the human world, the heavenly beings, the asuras, all these realms of sentient beings, the beings there think that the present Shakyamuni Buddha, that's me, he said. The one with two eyes and two ears, nose and tongue. All these beings think that this present Shakyamuni Buddha left the palace of the Shakya clan, where my father and mother wept when I left home without really saying goodbye. But I left home, I sat at the way place. I sat at the dojo, the Bodhi Mandala, not far from the city of Gaya, and there attained supreme awakening. You all heard the story. We've heard it too, right? We're beings in the human realm. We heard that too. Many, many centuries later, that Shakyamuni Buddha left home. He sat under that Bodhi tree and realized supreme awakening. But, good disciples, in fact, there have been innumerable, unlimited, hundreds of thousands of billions of myriads of eons since I became a Buddha. And they were like, okay, wait a second, just stop that Buddha. This is, like, not what we heard before. You already told us that you left home at such and such a time, and you sat under that tree, and this is what you realized. We heard it last Rohatsu Sashin. We heard the whole story. Now you're saying that you didn't realize awakening at that time, but that you became a Buddha innumerable, unlimited, hundreds of thousands of myriads of myriads of eons ago? Whoa. Shakyamuni Buddha. This is quite a statement. During this time that I've talked to you about my life, I haven't talked about in this past, way past Kalpa, I met Burning Light Buddha, Dipankara Buddha, in this. He was like the first Buddha I met, like, millions of lifetimes ago. This is even in, like, the Pali, early teachings of the Pali Canon. The Buddha started this Bodhisattva path, meeting Dipankara Buddha. So here in the Lotus Sutra, he refers to that, and I talked about Dipankara entering Nirvana, and that was really hard for me at that time as a Bodhisattva. But all of this is just skillful means, I've told you. Dipankara Buddha didn't enter Parinirvana at that time. Everything I've told you up to now has just been stories. I think it's... when they first heard this Lotus Sutra, they, you know, devout Buddhists who, basing their lives on the Buddhist sutras, Well, maybe like, this is really quite something. All the sutras that were spoken before were just skillful means and stories about different lifetimes and so on. Oh, good children, good disciples of Buddha, all the sutras taught by the Tathagata are for the purpose of freeing all beings from suffering. Sometimes I speak of myself, sometimes I speak of others. Sometimes I appear as myself. Sometimes I manifest as Shakyamuni Buddha with two eyes and two ears and a tiny curl of hair on my forehead. Sometimes I appear like that, but sometimes I appear as someone else, the Buddha says. Sometimes I appear in my own actions, like lifting up a flower and twirling it. Sometimes I appear like that, but sometimes I appear in the actions of others. Wow. But all that I say is true and not empty. So Buddha, sometimes I appear like this, and I've appeared like this for a while, walking around Rajagir and up and down Vulture Peak and with all of you in the assembly. Sometimes I appear like this. You kind of know me this way, but sometimes I appear as others. He doesn't say it, but he might have said, sometimes I appear as you. He could have said. Then here's a really central section, I think, here. Why is this, the Buddha says? The Tathagata, the Buddha, has insight into the character of the three realms, as it really is, the three realms of, like, our human realm, the desire realm, where we're pushed and pulled around by desires, and then there's the form realm, where it's just like pure blue, pure red. There's no, there's nothing, no additional conceptual elaboration. And then there's the formless realm, where there's not even blue and red. All realms of samsara, these are the three realms of sentient beings, basically. It's a Buddhist way of saying all realms of birth and death of sentient beings. The Buddha has insight into the character of these three realms, all realms. For the Buddha, there is no birth or death, neither retreat from nor emergence into the world. Nor is there any existing in the world and entering extinction or cessation following that existence. Nothing is simply real. Nothing is simply empty. Nothing is as it seems. Nor is it the opposite. Nothing is as it seems. Doesn't it seem like we're here in Sesshin now and sitting here? But it's not as it seems here, but it's not opposite either. These three realms of sentient beings is not as we experience it. This is what the Buddha is saying. This us being here now, it in reality is not the way we experience it. The Tathagata sees all such things clearly without mistake. Because living beings have different natures, different desires, different activities, and different assumptions and ways of thinking, because I wanted to lead them to plant roots of goodness, I had used lots of different causal explanations, parables, and other kinds of expressions to share various teachings. I've never for a moment neglected the Buddha's work. Thus, since I became Buddha, a very long time has passed, a lifetime of innumerable, countless eons of constantly living here and never entering cessation. I'm always here, the Buddha is saying. I'm always abiding here. I never cease. This lifetime of innumerable eons, constantly abiding here, constantly, unceasingly, permanently abiding here, never ceasing. From the beginning, I have practiced the Bodhisattva way, and that life is not yet finished, the Buddha says. That life, this life, is not yet finished. So that section right there, from the beginning, I have practiced the Bodhisattva way, and that life is not yet finished. That's one of the lines where Dogen starts to comment. Dogen quotes that line and then says, "Know that it is not that the lifespan of the Bodhisattva has continued without end only until now." Don't think that the Buddha living in this very, very long lifespan has continued without end only until now, or not that the lifespan of the Buddha has prevailed only in the past, but what is called vast numbers, Dogen says, is a total inclusive attainment. What is called still now is the total lifespan. Dogen's just playing with these words of the sutra. In other words, this present moment right now is the total lifespan. And what is called vast numbers of eons is a total inclusive realization. Even if, quoting the sutra, "In the past I practiced," the Buddha says, even if that statement is one solid piece of iron 10,000 miles long, it casts away hundreds of years vertically and horizontally. This is the way Dogen talks about the Lotus Sutra. Again, even if in the past I practiced for all these eons, even if that is one solid piece of iron like a railway track 10,000 miles long, it casts away hundreds of years vertically and horizontally. He's trying to help us let go of any conceptual grasping of what's going on here. This 10,000 mile solid iron railroad track is casting away hundreds of years vertically and horizontally. Please do not try to figure it out. This being so, Dogen says, practice and verification is neither existence nor beyond existence. Practice and verification is undefiled. I think he's trying to talk us into we are here now in Sishin residing in the inconceivable lifespan of the Tathagata. We're part of it. Not even really that we're part of it. We are it. There's no other part of it. This is it. And it's we can't even calculate how long ago this began. And there doesn't seem to be an end. But there is the appearance of particular Buddhas like Shakyamuni Buddha who seem to be born at Lumbini, enlightened at Bodh Gaya, taught at Varanasi, and entered Parinirvana between the twin sala trees in Kushinagara. But Buddha saying, I know I told you that story, but actually, this Buddha thing started way, way before that. This Buddha thing, I, Shakyamuni Buddha, realized Buddhahood these eons ago. I'll spare you the paragraphs that explain how to calculate how many eons. Like grinding up all the land on the earth into tiny particles, tiny like the smallest like dust motes, and then kind of like spreading them all out, and then kind of counting each one of these dust motes as an eon, which is the length of time it takes for like the tip of a bird's feather to wear away Mount Everest if they pass by it once every like 10,000 years. I'll spare you that part. But it was a long time ago that the Buddha realized awakening.
Not really.
But interestingly, I think it's interesting and a little bit jarring after all these Buddha nature teachings about the eternal Dharmakaya. In the fall, we heard so much about eternal, unchanging, beginningless and endless. That this story, it's a very, very huge number of eons, but it doesn't say beginningless. And of course, people like Juri and these teachers, of course, picked up on that. And they're like, he didn't say, I've always been a Buddha. He said, I actually realized Buddhahood a long time ago, but it wasn't like beginningless time ago. That puts a twist on it, I think, here. And he doesn't really talk about the future. Sometimes it's maybe implied that there's going to be no end to this now that it's started. Dogen also comments on this line. So that part that I read about the 10,000 foot solid piece of iron is in the Shobo Genzo chapter called The Awesome Presence of Active Buddhas. And there's another Shobo Genzo chapter called The Tathagata's Entire Body, where Dogen comments on the same line of the Lotus Sutra about, I practiced the Bodhisattva way in the past and attained this long, long lifespan. And Dogen says in this, to target his whole body, about this line, he says, my life, he says, this is the Tathagata's entire body, this lifespan, this inconceivable lifespan of the Buddha is the Buddha's entire body. The billion worlds are a piece of his compassionate heart, a bit of his boundless realm, the Tathagata's entire body. So the billion worlds of the universe are a piece of the Buddha's compassionate heart, a bit of his boundless realm. So even we might say that the hell realms in our world where there's great, great suffering must also be a piece of the Buddha's compassionate heart. That's, I think, very hard for me and I imagine you to open to and understand. How could the Buddha's inconceivably loving, compassionate heart take the form of the horrors of hells and starvation and warfare and tragedy? I think this chapter is asking us to really open beyond our usual conceptions of like, this is not good, and we gotta get rid of this stuff, and this is good, we gotta get this stuff, and that's why we're gonna eat oatmeal with gomashio instead of chocolate hearts on Valentine's Day. Wouldn't it be better to eat gomashio and oatmeal? We're asking, like, how can we really open our heart so wide as to see that the billions of worlds and billions of worlds in Buddhism usually means sentient beings. That's what worlds are. Billions of sentient beings, happy and sad and distraught, and all kinds of sentient beings are a piece of the Buddha's compassionate heart. And as we open like that, then we start to align more and more with Buddha's compassionate heart. So our compassionate heart can open to such realms of suffering. The Lotus Sutra is known for being this this sutra of several hundred pages, where it's kind of like there's a lot of introduction of like the Buddha saying, earlier on in the sutra, the Buddha's like, I'm gonna teach you something you've never heard before, this one vehicle, and get ready. And one of the stories in the sutra is like, at the time he said this, a whole bunch of disciples of the Buddha in the assembly are like, we've been here long enough in this Dharma talk. I think let's go have lunch. And they left when the Buddha was about to like, I'm going to teach you something you've never heard. And they all left, a whole bunch of them. And some of them, the Bodhisattvas who stayed, were like, wait a second, just don't let them go. You're about to tell it as it is, right? And Buddha said, no, it's okay. They can go have lunch. And but you who are still here, you're in for a treat now. You keep turning the pages faster and faster. Where's the treat? And then you get to the very end of the sutra, and it's like, what was it? It's kind of like the Lotus Sutra is kind of known as kind of a strange sutra in that way. It's like there's all this kind of setup. You're about to get this great thing, and you keep looking for it, but you can't quite. You're waiting for the punchline, chapter after chapter, waiting for the punchline. And then you finally, there's only a few pages left, and you start to get worried. And then you get to the end, and it's like, maybe I read it too fast. And maybe it's a skillful means to get you to go back and read slower. But actually, it might not be that there's a punchline. Or else each word is a punchline. It was a tradition, because in China, where it's just so, sutra was so revered, that every Chinese character, thousands and thousands that make up the sutra, is itself a Buddha. Sorry, I just have to open this. Because it struck me when I looked at this cover. Especially the edge of the cover. I don't know if y'all can see it. It says, The Lotus Sutra. And somehow when it struck me, I just saw the the is so big there. The is like just as big as lotus and sutra. Isn't it? It's a little smaller there, but the, like, why did, like, you know, the most important sutra, like the most important binding, why did they take up so much space writing the? There's no word for the in Sanskrit or Chinese. Could have just said Lotus Sutra, but it says the. So anyway, in China, every single word they felt like is a Buddha. And there was, some people would copy out the sutra, and they'd write the Chinese character, and they'd put like a lotus under it. Like, you know, Buddhas sit on like a lotus throne. So maybe first they would paint the lotus, a lotus flower, like a three-dimensional lotus flower, and then they'd write the character on top. Like, that character is a Buddha. That word of the sutra is itself a Buddha. And they write the whole sutra like that. Can you imagine that act of devotion to paint that many lotus flowers for each word? But when I saw this word, the, it's like, if we were copying this now, we could do a really exquisite lotus flower we could paint and then put the word the on top of it. I think that's the spirit of the sutra, I think, is because there's no punchline, the word the can be like a Buddha sitting on top of a lotus. That's actually a beautiful word in English, you know, because there's no curves in the word at all. It's just verticals and horizontals leaping beyond 10,000 miles of iron. Thus comes under a big shining lotus flower and jewels raining down on the word thus. Have. Let's offer 10,000 flowers to the word have. I. Whoa, now that is the supreme vertical pole reaching from the deepest heaven to the deepest heaven to the highest hell. That pole called I. That one deserves 20,000 rice pudding bowls topped with hot fudge. Heard. It's, I can't even say it. How many offerings such a word should receive. Homage to the each word of the Siddharma Pundarika Sutra. May each word free us from grasping some fixated content of words. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.